All right. Thank you, Brother Wildman. And again, thank you all for being here. And thank you also for singing that song. If we hadn't have gotten that out of our systems before we started, I was just going to have us sing it. The only problem is that after we sing that song, what else is there to say, right? It's all pretty much been covered. But we're in our Bibles in Luke chapter 19, and we'll look at the text together with the time that we have. As we're looking at this story, of course, the overall objective of the series is in considering how to invite, each day covering how or profiling the sort of person that we will engage in our lives and the different ways that the invitations will change. Certainly not the fundamentals, not the message, but the approach will necessarily be different. So as we're looking through this, considering what kind of man Zacchaeus was, what level his interest was, and what Jesus had to do in order to get his attention, hopefully as time permits at the end, but I'm saying this now because I expect I'll run out of time, I would ask us to consider as we go through how this invitation translates today as we hold gospel as the body of Jesus Christ. I'm sure most of us are aware at one level or another of the various shenanigans that the IRS has been called out for over the years, using their powers of audit and prosecution to punish political enemies. If they wanted to, they could. That's pretty well established. But they can't. It's not just that they have. They will again. The tax system grants extraordinary power to the IRS. In 2013, during a congressional investigation of charges that the IRS was deliberately targeting Tea Party-affiliated groups, when the prosecution requested to see emails relevant to the case, the IRS refused. When testifying, exempt organization's division director Lois Lerner claimed a computer glitch erased the computer hard drives of all incriminating evidence. Congress asked if they could check that out for themselves. They said no, because it just so happens that the very hard drives had been turned in and destroyed for recycling, because the IRS is very green, apparently. And not long after, Congressman Steve Stockman of Texas, in a bit of grandstanding before the press, introduced a sensationalistic piece of legislation doomed to not go anywhere, but it was called the Dog Ate My Tax Receipts Act. Stockman argues that since the taxpaying public shouldn't be held to a higher standard than their humble public servants in the IRS, they should be able to offer, quote, the same flimsy, obviously made up excuses offered by the top dogs at the IRS. They should be able to also claim, well, the dog ate my receipts, or that they have a convenient, unexplained, miscellaneous computer malfunction. I say all that just to review that people have a timeless disdain for legal plunder. In fact, there's a phrase in our New Testament so familiar it's almost a churchism. Jesus dined with tax collectors and They go so naturally. Of course, it's a Bibleism. It's not our phrase. It's theirs. Tax collectors and sinners. But that's the point for that time. They were peas in a pod. Here's how the system worked in that day. Judea was under Roman rule. They were not happy about this. The Romans collected a poll tax, a land tax, and an income tax. And how they collected was they contracted out the powers to collect these taxes. And those positions went to the highest bidder. So these people, of course, tended to be wealthy. They had to be wealthy because they paid the Romans the amount up front. Now the question is, why would anybody do this? And Brother Wildman has already covered a little bit of the motivation for that. The same reason exists today for why people buy their way into political office today. They spend a fortune getting into office, then it's time to get richer by manipulating the laws into yours and into your cronies and supporters' favor. See, Rome expected to receive their three major taxes, but the tax collectors, they could add on whatever they wanted to. Bridge tax, road tax, city limits tax, wheel tax, casual Friday tax. Tax collectors paid the Romans up front. Then they got to keep whatever they collected. So they paid for the power to be backed by the sword of Rome at the people's necks. Legal plunder. They could demand whatever they wanted. Now that is a strong incentive for dishonesty. They were known for some of the same corruption that's being prosecuted and comes up in the mail and in the media and disappears without consequence today. They could, verse 8 says, defraud their personal enemies. Hey, you didn't pay your taxes, like Brother Waldman covered with the children. When tax collectors came to hear John the Baptist preach, and this is back in Luke chapter 3, they asked him what they ought to do. Do you remember what he said to them? What was the instruction to tax collectors? He said, collect no more than you are authorized to do. Meaning whatever they hired you to collect. So that's asking them to remove, to take a hit, because they paid for this and they're not going to make any profit from it. On top of that, keep in mind that the Jews were a subjugated people. Any Jew who collected customs and duties for the occupying Roman Empire was, in the mind of, in Old Testament terminology, these people were outside the camp. Tax collectors got lumped in with sinners because they flagrantly, publicly violated the cultural and religious norms of Judaism. Jesus painted the perfect picture of this sort of sinner when he told the story of the prodigal son. Because that guy was the ultimate sinner. He dishonored his father. He went and he lived in a pig pen. That's the ultimate fate of an outside the camp Jew. It wasn't just that they wore the uniform of Rome, tax collectors. It's that they also had a reputation for making extra money by also making loans at exorbitant rates. So usury, which was forbidden by the law of Moses within and among your own people. Their profession then involved suspicion and harassment, and it operated by force. Let's look at Luke chapter 19 now. Get into our text, verse 1. He entered Jericho and was passing through. Luke 19 falls very near the end of Jesus' journey. He's passing through. He's on his way from a place to a place. He's been going from Galilee to Jerusalem. And this is recorded in Luke from about the end of chapter 9 to 19 verse 44. So he's almost there. We're in 19. In Luke, a loosely structured travelogue, it's mainly focused on Jesus' teaching. It's where we get all of those unique parables that Luke shares with us. As the Lord nears Jerusalem, as we know, he's coming to the consummation of his purpose. And as he approaches, he makes plainer to his disciples what he is intending to do, what's going to happen, just exactly what is going to occur. And with what, and with the grave news, well, there's also a confrontational appeal. You have to get this. You have to understand what discipleship is. I'm about to bear discipleship on a cross. So this stretch of narrative and teaching on the road to Jerusalem, it's a very difficult path of discipleship. At the same time, Jesus' debates with his opponents are also ramping up. So he's getting franker, much more raw with his disciples. He's also getting a lot more animated with his critics. It's getting a lot more confrontational. His plain-spoken condemnations are provoking them to finalize these wicked schemes they've had with him for so long. And they're almost there. So the words up to Jerusalem frame this section of scripture. They're said in 18 verse 31 and again in 19:28. Jericho is the final gauntlet. It is the last significant town before leaving the Jordan Valley to go up. Jericho at this time was a prosperous place. It was kind of a resort town for the wealthy and for, it was an important trade channel is one thing. Now in my picture of the tax collectors of that day, you'll note the building there is an archaeological reconstruction of the administrative center that was there in Jericho. You might notice the pretty tree-lined avenue there. That's relevant to our story. It was Herod the Great had and his son Archelaus had made it even more beautiful. They built their winter palace there. They had a theater. They had a hippodrome, a horse track. The climate was delightful. It was described by one commentator as a little paradise. Some of the streets were lined, indeed, with sycamore trees. So here is where we meet Zacchaeus. Verse 2. And there was a man called by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. That's what Luke wants us to know. Okay, strike one. He was a chief tax collector. Jericho was a customs point for all goods that were entering Palestine over from the east. It was one of three major tax offices. The other two in this area were in Caesarea and in Capernaum, which of course was where Levi had a lower down the totem pole, but that was where he was posted. As chief tax collector, chief, we don't know, Levi was not that high up from all indications, but Zacchaeus received a share of all the revenues that he and all of his lower collectors gathered in. He was doing very well for himself. And as you know, where there is corruption, the higher up you go in the chain, the greater the complicity is with the system. The less you can say, oh, well, I didn't know. I was just doing what I was told. Strike two, Luke says, he was a chief tax collector and he was rich. And he connects the two. It's not like he happened to be rich before, which he would have had to have been. But he's rich because he's a chief tax collector. In the Gospel of Luke especially, that highlights a spiritual handicap. Because so often those who are wealthy are lacking in a sense of spiritual dependency. Now that's an important thing. Luke doesn't say wealth is bad, but the sense of spiritual dependency is the challenge for a wealthy person. They don't have a need, a felt need in the world. And Jesus says that's going to be a barrier. Luke chapter 6 verse 24. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you shall be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. He's not anti-laughing, anti-wealth. But what he's saying here is the problem is if all of your stuff is stacked in the now and you're not looking at the later, you're prone not to look to the later. Strike three, he was short. And we all know the stereotype, right? Napoleon, the Penguin, the Monopoly guy, that weird villain from The Lorax. Rich, bad, short. With the cartoon guy, that just kind of demonstrates how this has become he's like a walking metaphor. He's a little man. He's a petty man. He only focuses on these things. Well, we have no idea if that was a prejudice or a thing in that day against short people. His height here is important. Luke doesn't share it as a negative. He just shares it as part of telling us about his interest. Why does he need to do what he does? Verse 3, Zacchaeus was trying to see who Jesus was and was unable because of the crowd, for he was small in stature. Just sets up the problem. He would like to get a look at Jesus. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree in order to see him, for he was about to pass through that way. Before we get too excited about Zacchaeus's big climb, what kind of approach is this? Let's compare it to some people who previously have sought after Jesus just inside the Gospel of Luke, the paralytic. What did he do to get to Jesus? He had his friends install a skylight in the place where Jesus was staying. And for what purpose? He wanted to be healed. Think about the sinful woman with the expensive ointment in Luke 7 verse 38. The woman with the discharge of blood in Luke chapter 8 verse 44. Blind Bartimaeus just the chapter before this on the outskirts of the old city of Jericho. That man calling out and then following immediately. Now how does Zacchaeus compare just to the list of these that we've gone through in Luke? He isn't approaching. He is not seeking. He's not getting into the parade. He wants to watch the parade. He is an enthusiastic observer. Now think about this as we transfer over. We've already established that the Zacchaeus person, the stranger, may not be the most likable, may not even be in the terms of the profile of their life and their life decisions and their income and their whatever their situation is, structurally speaking, from the ground up, they are not a desirable prospect in terms of us thinking about, I could probably get them to come to church. But this person shows some interest, but it's just a look. Just want to get a look at Jesus. The great prophet, the worker of miracles, is passing through with a big crowd and much acclaim. This is going to go into the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. He wants to see the procession as it is passing through. So he has a very real but a functionally passive interest. Now maybe this has to do with him inside himself saying, I'm not a candidate. That ship has sailed. Maybe it has that sad core to the center of it, that he just evaluates himself of, this is not for me. Or maybe not. Maybe he's not that deep of a thinker about his life station. He wasn't trying to be touched. He wasn't trying to be healed. He didn't want to hear a word from him. Just a good look. You know, maybe cheer for him on his way. True interest. But Zacchaeus is, as we would say, just a fan. But who is doing the seeking in this story? At the closer analysis, look at verse 5. So when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for today I must stay at your house. The startling thing in this story is not how far out of his way Zacchaeus goes to reach Jesus. It is how far out of his way Jesus goes to reach Zacchaeus. Can you imagine how startling it must have been for him to hear his name? I mean, imagine you are at a public appearance of one of your favorite singers or celebrities or public figures, and you're out there in the crowd and suddenly everything stops and that person says, hey, Mitch! This is another one of those, this is a minor miracle, isn't it? It's a demonstration of Jesus' divine knowledge that he knows the names of everybody on that street, including the weirdo up in the tree. And it just kind of goes without saying, but it makes the entire story happen. So Jesus knew him, and he says, hurry and come down. Now here is where the divine call meets human obligation. And here, evangelistically speaking, is where we will have a moment where that person, you have to extend the invitation. You have to notice an interest, but then you have to perhaps challenge it to come out from the wings and say, yes, this is for you. This is urgent. Hurry up. Time is limited, but then the ball passes back to them. Human obligation. Jesus is calling Zacchaeus out from being a spectator and into discipleship. Come out, come down, off your perch, come out of separation. For years, Zacchaeus was cut off from his fellow Jews on account of his valuing of money over being in solidarity with his people. Think of how many people structure and choose to build their lives in a way that also sets them apart. But come down. Change that. Follow me. Don't merely be an observer. Don't just be a fan. Christianity is not a spectator sport. You've got to have the come down moment. He says, for I must stay at your house today. Now notice that imperative. I must. This is, the story begins with Jesus. It says he's passing through. We know he has an appointment in Jerusalem. He's starting to tell us in plainer and plainer terms. And yet this is not a detour. This is exactly what he is there to do. It's what he came to earth to do. I must stay at your house today. When you come down and you follow Jesus, here's the next thing. It needs to come home. It's got to live with you. You can't just come and commune with it in the pew and then go home to a life like you had before. Jesus did not say, will it be convenient for you to have me come visit? but he challenged something in the nature of this man. The same thing that motivated him to climb a tree when his objective had been just to see Jesus. Seeing him was a lesser objective, but Jesus is testing to see if Zacchaeus will rise to the occasion of an even bigger invitation. Maybe he will. Verse 6. And he hurried and came down and received him gladly. So it's not that Zacchaeus wouldn't have followed. It's just that he needed to be called out. That's what the invitation is for. And maybe 1 out of 10 will be like this. But you're looking for that 1 out of 10. We don't have the insight of Jesus. Well, I admit that as well. That means we need to expand our target. Who might be like this? He just needed to be called out. He just needed the invitation. And as soon as he is, his interest blossoms into something that is so much greater. It answers all the doubts that we had before of what exactly would Zacchaeus do. It does lend a little bit more credit to maybe there is something broken inside him. That yes, he willfully chose this path, but now he's defeated. He feels like, well, this is it. This is who I am. So here's where the story takes a real turn and where we learn some of what Zacchaeus knows about his heritage. The tax collecting, rich, short man Zacchaeus is revealed as a hero. And who now are the potential antagonists in the story? Verse 7. When they saw it, they all began to grumble, saying, he has gone to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. The grumbling. Now that's a word. At this point in the narrative, it usually calls to mind scribes and Pharisees. And I only say that because if you're reading Luke, they are the ones who grumble in chapter 5, in chapter 7, in chapter 15. But here, it doesn't say that. It just says they. Everyone. Everyone is potentially positioned in the camp of the opponents of Jesus, the grumblers. And they say, this is not your kind of people, Lord. You need not waste your time. There are a number of episodes that lead up to this point in Luke that are called to mind within this story. You've got the call of Levi the tax collector up in Capernaum. That's in chapter 5, verse 27. There's the blind beggar just before in chapter 18, verse 36. That calls to mind the story of the rich man and Lazarus. You see, Bartimaeus is like Lazarus. He's the man sitting, begging at the gate. And Zacchaeus then, is he like the rich man from that story? We just saw somebody who's like Lazarus. Just before that, Jesus encountered a rich young ruler verse 18 through 30. So you compare those two men, the rich young ruler and Zacchaeus, the rich tax collector. Now the ruler had everything going for him. You remember, right? He was a law keeper. He was righteous. Everybody was shocked at how that encounter went. In the opposite direction, because it ended with this guy sorrowfully walking away from Jesus, and he was assumed to be in his camp. Zacchaeus, on the other hand, has everything against him. Everything. With false profiling within 2 chapters, we ought to be surprised by who doesn't and ought to, and who does, and by all things on paper, shouldn't. But what could Zacchaeus do that the rich young ruler could not? What was that? That one thing remaining for that rich ruler was to hand over his life utterly to Jesus, to signal that commitment to Jesus by selling all of his possessions and giving them to the poor. Now, wait a second, because Jesus was going to make the young man give away everything, right? Give away all that you have. Zacchaeus, he only gives away half. So is that a fair comparison? It is. Because first of all, Jesus did not order him, give away half your stuff, did he? That's not how the conversation went. Zacchaeus, did he only, did he let half of it go? Or in volunteering what he does in these verses, does he demonstrate that if it takes all of it, that's what it'll take. The Lord is in control. Jesus says a lot about how to handle your wealth. The Gospel of Luke records a lot of it. The main idea is not that being rich is sinful because money is bad. The cure for being physically rich and spiritually rich at the same time is not dispossession, it is disposition. The people who are relieved that Jesus' followers don't really have to sell all their possessions, though, are just the kind of people that Jesus would say, oh, no, you have to give up all of it. We don't need to go looking for the exception. Well, do I get to keep my wealth? No, you're not letting go of it, are you? Let's look at verse 8. Zacchaeus stopped and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, half of my possessions I will give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will give back four times as much." Now, here's where Zacchaeus reveals his Jewishness, I think. He says, "If I have defrauded anyone." Now, is that an admission of guilt, or is he defending that he is innocent? That's a discussion to be had. The statement, at least according to Hendrickson, is grammatically a first-class or simple conditional sentence. That just means it is a statement that is assumed to be true. So exhibit A in this then is that grammatically speaking, he's not saying, "I haven't, I challenge you to find someone who has." If there's any doubt about Zacchaeus' guilt in his wording, Jesus clearly casts Zacchaeus as the lost in verse 10. So what he's doing in his life's disposition is not kosher. But this will from now on, this will be his practice. That's what he's saying. The great little man is taking a stand. He's humbling himself. According to the law of Moses, and this is where I think, this is where we get into to what Zacchaeus knows. If a person voluntarily turns himself in and confesses, "I stole," he was to pay back the amount stolen plus a 20% penalty. That's in Leviticus 6 and Numbers chapter 5. However, if he were caught stealing, the penalty that was impressed on that person was double the original amount stolen, and in some cases where livestock was involved, so you know the animal had already been slain, the penalty was fourfold or fivefold. The Mishnah, which is a book of traditional Jewish applications of the law, scaled that back. Kind of said, well, let's make it twofold. Let's just call it twofold and we're good. Now, Zacchaeus is not doing a Mishnah move. He's not saying, well, the law says twofold, that's good. But he's not fulfilling a rule here either, because Jesus has given no command. But what does Zacchaeus' free will offering, as the saying goes today, what does it resemble? It resembles when you go back and look for fourfold in the old law, the compulsory penalty for repaying stolen property. If you are caught guilty. And it surpasses the voluntary amount. Zacchaeus, who is a person who is outside of the law, is by nature doing the things of the law. As Paul argues in Romans, that noble inner instinct that surpasses the Jews who are trying to just follow every jot and tittle. He's acting as if by compulsion. Now that's the important thing. Zacchaeus feels caught. Zacchaeus feels like he's been hooked and pulled in and compelled. So what compulsion is he under? I think the impulse is similar to Paul's. Indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake, I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish, fit for the trash heap, fit for the septic tank is kind of his wording fits there, in order that I may gain Christ. Meanwhile, the crowd who believe themselves to be firmly within the security of the law of Moses are looking out at Zacchaeus and they're dismissing him. That's a sinner. Are they wrong? They're accurate. Jesus says he's a sinner in verse 10. But what is their response to that truth? Here's the difference, and here's the evangelistic challenge for us. Both of us can sit there, the one who wants to invite and the ones who doesn't want to change anything, and say, that's a sinner. Jesus, the crowd, Zacchaeus, all of them agree across the board, this guy's a sinner. The big difference here now is, what are we going to do about it? What's the crowd say? Well, no, that's a sinner. Done. Zacchaeus proves to surpass the law of Moses voluntarily. Meanwhile, the crowd is content to sit back and identify the face of the law only. So now, here's where the tables turn. Who is the one who is now high up and on a lofty perch, just watching things pass by? Zacchaeus is down. The crowd is now up. This story, and the one before it, the one about the blind beggar Bartimaeus, as they are told, they answer a very big question that's left hanging just one chapter back. At the conclusion of the encounter with the rich young ruler, the bewildered disciples ask, then who can be saved? And it's left there. Jesus shows us a person with faith like Bartimaeus. A person who bears fruit in keeping with repentance, like Zacchaeus. Luke chapter 3, verse 8. Bear fruits in keeping with repentance, and do not begin to say to yourselves, we have Abraham as our father. For I tell you, God is able from these stones to raise up children for Abraham. Tax collectors respond positively to Jesus, and they are some of the best loved characters in Luke's drama. It's something that just passes us by. But Levi, Zacchaeus, the tax collector who can only pray, God be merciful to me, a sinner. Luke likes bringing these people out of the margins. He likes picking people and showing the unlikely prospect and exactly how they can surprise you in the grace of God. Verse 9, Jesus said to him, to this amazing voluntary submission to repentance, Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. That's how you make a son of Abraham. Today, one who is a son of Abraham by faith, who shares the works of their forefather, that is the true son. So today is connected to salvation a whole lot in the Gospel of Luke. The word today. It shows us the urgency then of our continuous practical response to salvation. When is salvation? Look it up in Luke, and the answer is today. Today salvation has come. Johnson renders the phrase, salvation has happened in this house. It happens because that household is changed by salvation. It's not just something that's declared, it's an occurrence. They are blessed, and now that household is a house that dispenses blessing. Zacchaeus' salvation has a personal, a domestic, a social, an economic impact on the man and on the world that is around him. And that's why when you convert someone like this, someone who knows exactly how low a person can go because they have gone there and they have decided that's the kind of person they are, you know those people become your best people seekers. And who do they seek? They bring their families. They bring their former friends. I love the stories of the really, really dark and gritty people, and then all of the weird visitors that you get who are like, what did this church do to change that person's life? I just want to see. You get some more Zacchaeuses coming in, looking in the back pew and not having any idea what's going on. You get more chances. So we may come here out of our way to passively participate in honoring Jesus, to watch Jesus parade past in communion. But the danger of a passing interest is that you're in the presence of Jesus. You get near Jesus and he just might call you out. You get in the Bible, and even if your intent is just to get some stuff read during the day, it may cut you. And he wants to come back home with you. He says, no, I want your spare room. I want your living room. I want your car. So do you let him in? Will you acknowledge what he already knows when he looks right in you, right through you? Will you transform your home for his sake? Zacchaeus is not the hero of his story. We're not the heroes of our stories. The story concludes with what might be the definitive thematic verse of the entire Gospel of Luke. I've looked at a couple of introductions to the New Testament, and a lot of them like to pick kind of what's the thesis verse. 19:10. I've seen it many times. So it's the end of this story gives us the purpose of the Gospel of Luke in a really nice, neat summation. And it says, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." To seek. That reminds us that Jesus wasn't just making a detour from passing through. Again, I must come to your house. This is all about why he came. He wanted to see Zacchaeus. Seek and save the lost. Now that recalls the stories that you have in chapter 15. The lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son. And of course, like Zacchaeus, we think the lost son is the one who's face down in the pig pen, having wasted an inheritance in his father's house. The prodigal, the definite sinner among tax collectors and sinners. But of course, we know that there are two lost sons in that story, aren't there? And that's the challenge in this story, is that Zacchaeus gets saved. Salvation comes to his house. But then you still have the lost older brother story. Everyone else who's muttering, that's a sinner. Sitting and observing. Zacchaeus climbs up into a tree for Jesus. But now Jesus is going to go and climb up into a tree for him. And he does that for all of us. We need to honor that. Well, we did make it to the end. We made it to our verses. So, let's consider then who this prospect is. One more time, in summation. What sort of choices do people make that alienate them from an invitation from you? What sorts of life decisions might you see as a barrier? Here's where I'm opening it up. I want to get some interaction because we have a few minutes. So that's going to be a problem that all of us at some degree are going to encounter then. That we all have a certain pride that keeps us against change. But that sort of tracks with what I hear you saying. So when we're inviting so it doesn't have to be somebody who is economically on the edge, right? Zacchaeus is not in the gutter with the sinners because he's poor, because he's disadvantaged. He has every advantage. Wealth is one of the barriers to him. Well, we live in a wealthy society. We live with wealthy neighbors in a wealthy city. So the pride of that may be, well, this is what I've always been. And to change, to move, to follow you is somehow to take a step down. And it really does require that, doesn't it? Humility. Here goes my alarm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not even really necessarily interested in seeing him, are they? They're up in the tree because Jesus is like a coon dog and they've been treed. We've got to say, come down. We might get some Jesus fans though, won't we? I mean, I kind of see that as the person who, I know it, when you have conversations, and I know Brother Wildman, Brother Plunkett, you have this too, when it comes around to the topic of what do you do, and I say I'm a preacher, and they're like, well, good for you. And I'm like, hold on a second. I might have said in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or at the whatever. It's just as broad across the board. Well, that's just great. That's good. So there's just this broad thumbs-upness for Jesus. And we've got to challenge that, don't we? If we see it. Is that a missing opportunity there? If a person says, yay for Jesus, you're a preacher, that's good. Well, don't slap that down. You want to be gracious. You want to be kind. You want to be thankful that they're glad that you do preach. But then there was that next, the come down moment then, is in saying, well, it matters very much what I proclaim. And thankfully, we both are very much in approval of who Jesus is. That means he has a claim on it. We ought to honor his claims. We ought to then, if we honor his claims that he's Lord, have to submit ourselves. You can't just say, Lord Jesus, and then not think to do what he says, how he says to do it. So Zacchaeus gives us this challenge of just escalating that opportunity from interest, looking past the obvious barriers. These are not illusions. But giving that person a chance to either say, no, I'm good up here. Or to come down and to enter into their lives and into their homes. That's a very important thing. All right. There you go. That's it. Yeah. Hey, you might not necessarily be able to say, I'm coming to your house right now. Right? It's a little bit of... Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's way less kid-friendly, so I understand why Zacchaeus is chosen, but the Samaritan woman is another perfect model for this kind of lesson, isn't she? And her sin was not economic, which is why perhaps... That's why we're singing the Zacchaeus song, not the Samaritan woman song. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because there's not really an indication that Zacchaeus follows him along. Bartimaeus is up and follows him, you assume, into Jerusalem. You don't have a following with Zacchaeus. You kind of have maybe a little bit more of the Gerasene situation where Jesus leaves him there because he's got a lot of work to do where he is. Making an impact. That says something too about our mission field, that there is a great nobility in someone being converted and then going off. But now there's my final dummy alarm for it's time to be quiet, so I'll wrap up this comment. But
we had a family in Hendersonville. His wife came faithfully every Sunday morning to all the services.
Uh-huh. So there's a man who is, his dispossession came from his disposition. That's an important thing. It reminds me of a cartoon I saw one time of the man's in the baptistry, and the guy says, now, as soon as you go in the water, everything that's in here belongs to Jesus. And the next frame is the guy underwater, but he's holding his wallet out. Thankfully, that man's wallet went underwater with him, didn't it? That's the effect it ought to have. Okay, well, that was my alarm. Let's get the kids back out here. Thank you again for participating with me today.